Well, generations come and go, but there's something that happens prior to that, and that's weddings. And I am not the expert at weddings. Actually, Jim Pagonis is the expert in this church in weddings. I don't know, what, you like 300, 400 weddings or more now? Probably more than that. But I like weddings. You like weddings? I really enjoy it. It's, I would say, one of the great privileges of being a pastor, be able to perform this ceremony and then join in the festivities that go with it. And, of course, you know, for me, it starts with the premarital counseling. These couple kind of float in, big eyes for each other. They have those romantic rose-colored glasses. Nothing is wrong in the world. It's nice. And then the bride starts talking about what she wants for wedding, and she pictures it, and it's just going to be just this way. And once in a while, the groom gets to join in. And all these years, there's only been about two or three grooms I've ever had that actually are that concerned about the ceremony. Usually theirs is, whatever you want, honey, anything you'd like it. I've only had a few that really want something, but they want it just, you know, that way. And then you get to perform the ceremony, and Jim would agree, it's kind of fun. You're up here, and you have the wedding party, and you're the only one that's really hearing the little conversations that are going on. Everybody else out there is looking, I wonder what they're saying. We're not telling. But you're part of that, and it's just a great joy, and, you know, they're holding hands, and they exchange their vows with each other. However, I admit, I have yet to see a wedding where every single detail came out just as planned. The complexity of it, the inexperience of those involved often results in mistakes. Some you would not even know about, though the bride always knows. others are very apparent. Sometimes they can be quite humorous, sometimes embarrassing. I recall several weddings. Actually, it was my brother's wedding. The organist started playing the bridal march early. And the people in the front of the church started standing up. Well, the mother of the bride was horrified. So she stands up and is going like this. Sit down, sit down. Well, the people in the back of the church, they don't know what's going on. They just see people stand. So they stand up. Meanwhile, the people in the front see the mother bride going like this. So they sit down. The people in the back then sit down. It's the first sporting event wedding I've ever been to. We had waves going on. It was really interesting. Now, fortunately, the bride didn't know about it until afterward because she wasn't in there. And then the groom was so nervous, and he was paying such close attention to the pastor to make sure that he heard every single word that he had to repeat in his vows so he would repeat it exactly as said. So the pastor was going on, and he read the vows, told the groom this, and at the end of it, he said to the groom, thank you, to the groom. Groom was concentrating so much, so he repeats the vows and looking at his bride, thank you. Now, it probably would have ended there, except the bride and her maid of honor found this very humorous. And they stood there trying to stifle it. Well, it kind of went right down the order of the bridesmaids. Pretty soon the pastor was laughing. Now the groomsmen join in. And the only person standing up there not laughing is the groom, who just stood there perplexed. What is going on? So, mistakes can make for humorous weddings. So those who have not had it, just understand, no matter what happens, it's an enjoyable event, and if you leave married, it was successful. Now, again, a main reason for such occurrences is that they are very formal occasions, and inexperience of those doing it often can lead to these kinds of mistakes happening. Well, weddings are also very extremely important within a family and also within society. And the many guests that add to this increases the people who are nervous. And when you take into account that a lot of times it's the first time some of these young adults have ever participated in something like this, such a very formal occasion, wearing a tux for the guys and these nice gowns for the gals, well, it's a good recipe for somebody to do something incorrectly. And while our society's practices of wedding customs are actually closer to that of ancient Rome than the ancient Jewish practice, yet there are still similarities between Jewish weddings and what happens in our own society. They're still important events in the family. They're important events in society. And mistakes happen. Mistakes can happen. You're not always prepared for everything that could possibly go on. This morning, we're going to be looking at a very important Jewish wedding. Now, it's not important because of who is getting married. In fact, we do not know the names of the bride, the groom, or the families involved. It is important because an error was made in the planning. And that error allows Jesus to perform a miracle which demonstrates that he is indeed the Son of God. Turn over to John chapter 2. John chapter 2. Now, before we look at the passage, I want to give you a little background on ancient Jewish weddings. So as we're going through this, you have some understanding of the events that are taking place here. Now, weddings are extremely important in Jewish society, not only as a great social event, but also because of their understanding of God's relationship with Israel, the betrothed. That's how it was described so often among the prophets, so they saw it that way. So a marriage was a reflection of that relationship and therefore a central focus of the celebration. Alfred Edersheim records the ancient Jewish marriage customs in the life and times of Jesus the Messiah. And a man and woman were then legally bound when they were betrothed to each other. They were actually, in a way, legally married, but they could not enjoy in the physical aspects of the marriage until the marriage ceremony itself, which could be up to a year later. The man would take that opportunity to actually physically build a place for his wife to live with him. So it was a preparation time. The only way you could really break it is a divorce or death. So somewhat similar to engagements, but legally binding. Now, on the evening of the wedding, usually a Wednesday, or what we would call a Wednesday, if it was a maid, the bride was led with a procession from her parents' home to the home of her betrothed. And the procession would be preceded by merry music. There would be those who out in front who would be giving gifts to the people along the way. It could be wine and oil and nuts to the children. The bride was surrounded by her friends. There would be people with torches so you could see. This is usually in the evening. She had a bridal veil on. Her hair would be flowing out of it, but she was covered. And it's just a joyous celebration. There was other maids who would be carrying myrtle and branches and flowers. Hence, we see where there's a lot of things that our ceremonies have that do tie back. And as the procession would wind through the streets, the people would come out and almost kind of an obligation to praise the bride and recount something about her her modesty, her beauty, her virtues. And so you can say it's just a great time, this procession going through. And a lot of times people just join in at the back of the line, and it gets longer and longer and longer. Now, when she arrives at the home of her betrothed, she's led to him, and then some sort of formula would be pronounced, such as, take her according to the law of Moses and of Israel. That's pronounced, and then the bride and the groom then would receive some sort of acknowledgement. Often a garland would be put on their heads. And then a legal document, it's called a ketubah, and it contained all the promises that were being made, that would be signed. And then there would be ceremonial washings of the hands, and it's followed by solemn prayer, and then the wedding feast begins. And that wedding feast was a lot of merriment. It could be a day. If you're rich enough, it could be 7 days. Imagine a 7-day party. Yeah, you have to be pretty rich for that. Finally, the bride and groom are led to the bridal chamber, and the marriage is consummated. Now, you can easily conclude from all this, there's a lot of planning, a lot of preparation that has to be done. And maybe that's another reason it takes a year from when you're betrothed to get it all together. It's a lot of planning. And depending on the wealth available, you might hire servants who would take care of a lot of that stuff for you, people very experienced in it. Or if you're more like the rest of us, you're kind of dependent on family and friends who will volunteer their time. Or you make them feel obligated and they volunteer their time. Something, right? But they're not hired, they're just helping out. Now, if you've been involved with such a thing, you know what happens in weddings. If you can hire people, they've got lots of experience, they know what they're doing, and they have a great obligation to get it done exactly right. If you have family and friends, That may or may not happen because, one, inexperience, and two, they're more interested in joining the party than fulfilling an obligation. So it's easy to have something overlooked. That appears to be the case in our text this morning. And yet God uses an error in this for the glory of his Son. Look at John 2, verse 1. And on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and Jesus was also invited, and his disciples, to the wedding. Now, the reference to the third day goes back to the day that Jesus found and called Philip and Nathanael. That's in John 1:43. Jesus had purposed to go back to Galilee. He found Philip and then Nathanael, and he called them to follow him. That's in addition to Andrew, Peter, and John, who were called the day before. Now, we do not know the exact location of Bethany beyond the Jordan, which is where he was at the time, John 1:28, or actually Cana of Galilee. We have some pretty good ideas about roughly where they were, but we don't know the exact location. Cana was about 9 miles northeast of Nazareth. Remember, that's where Jesus grew up. The two cities between each other, it's about 25 to 30 miles as you had to travel to get between them. And that's a reasonable journey to make in 3 days. So he's down in Cana and he travels up over that period of time. Now we're not told what the relationship Jesus has to this wedding party. We do know the mother is there and Jesus' mother is helping somehow, but we're not told, is this a relative? Are they just friends of the family? What's the connection here? We don't know. But it's interesting to note the grammar here emphasized the fact that Jesus is an invited guest. His mother has just mentioned that she is there. Jesus is an invited guest. And as we'll see in a few moments, Mary's got some kind of responsibility there, but it doesn't appear she's the invited guest. She's doing something. Now, again, she may have been friends of the family. Maybe it's some sort of relative. We don't know. Verse 12 indicates Jesus' brothers are there. That gives another indication. There's some kind of family connection there, friends or relatives. Now, Jesus is there for the wedding as guest and says his disciples are also. Now, whatever the reason Jesus is there, he's there, and he's supposed to be a guest. The disciples are there also. It doesn't say exactly how they are also invited, but we do know that Nathanael is from Cana of Galilee, so it's probably he's an invited guest because it's a small town. You know everybody, so he'd be there. The others actually don't live all that far away either, but they're also included. It doesn't state how many of the disciples. It's reasonable to assume it's all five that have so far been called, Andrew, John, Peter, Philip, and Nathanael, because it seemed kind of ludicrous for Jesus to call them and then say, oh, by the way, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'll see you in, you know, a few months. He goes with them. Actually, again, Nathanael's going back to his hometown. The others are going right back up to where they live anyways. A problem arises. A problem arises. Look at John 2, verse 3. And when the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. The wedding feast is being celebrated. They run out of wine. We're not told why they run out of wine, just that they have. Commentaries are always interesting, and it's interesting how people want to speculate why they ran out of wine. Who cares? Right? Because the issue isn't why you ran out. The issue is, how are you going to resolve the problem? If you've ever been at something like this, you understand that. It doesn't matter why it happened. It's just we've got to get this thing solved. Now, we may not understand this at first glance, but this is not, I repeat, this is not a minor inconvenience. This is a major problem. There are many American Christians that have the view that running out of wine was probably a blessing rather than a tragedy for them. But we must understand it from the perspective of these ancient Jews. How would they have seen it? For the Jews, wine was a symbol of God's blessing, and it is part of a joyous celebration. That's how they saw it. Some of you probably come from cultures that are similar to that. If you run out of wine in a wedding of certain ethnic groups, you're in trouble, all right? Because it's seen as such a part of the celebration. It's part of the joy. The Old Testament gives quite a few verses dealing with this. Let me give you a few of them. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10 instructs the godly Jew, how do you gain God's favor? Honor the Lord with your wealth from the first fruit of all your produce, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. Part of God's blessing, if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, abundance. That includes new wine. They understood wine to be something that God himself provided as a blessing. Psalm 104, verses 14 and 15 states this. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the labor of man so that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine which makes man's heart glad so that he may make his face glisten with oil and food which sustains man's heart. Again, they see God is providing it and it's part of his blessing. God's invitation to partake in his redemption blessings, amazing enough, includes wine. Isaiah chapter 55, verse 1. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat, come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Again, they viewed wine as an important and joyful element in a celebration. It's interesting, in Isaiah 25, 6, which is a passage looking to the millennium, that which is going to come, it talks about the banquet the Lord's going to serve. It says this, and the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all the peoples on this mountain, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow, and refined aged wine. So it's going to be served in the millennium. So to the people at this Jewish wedding feast, wine is an essential element for its celebration. To run out of wine would be a supreme embarrassment that would not only diminish the dreams of a beautiful wedding, but actually would have been considered very rude to the guests. So it's a serious problem. Now Mary, who is referred to in this passage simply as the mother of Jesus, as she actually is throughout John's Gospel, that's how she's referred to, seeks a solution to this problem. Again, we don't know her exact role within the wedding, but she has some role with helping with the feast, as her actions demonstrate. So she takes upon herself, she's got to find some way to resolve this problem. So when she becomes aware there's no more wine, she goes to Jesus, and she informs him. It's a very straightforward, factual statement. They have no wine. That's it. They have no wine. She doesn't tell Jesus what to do. She doesn't even ask him to do anything. It's just a statement. They have no wine. Jesus is her son, but he's no longer a child. She treats him with respect due an adult, in this case also respected rabbi. Now, why would Mary do this? Jesus is an invited guest. This is not his hometown. There are plenty of servants around who know the area that could be sent on an errand, go get some more wine. Why tell Jesus? He's a guest. Have you ever been at a wedding and they run out of something and they ask you as the guest to go figure it out for them? I hope not. You're supposed to be there to celebrate. But Mary just goes to Jesus. They have no wine. Now, there's a lot of speculation that can go about her motives, but the most obvious one is probably the right answer. Mary trusts Jesus to help. She, more than anybody else, knows the character and compassion that he has, as well as his actual identity. He is the Son of God. I think there's validity, too, that of some of the speculation, she expects Jesus will do a miracle. Now, why would that come in? Because, again, as you look toward the Messianic age, it was going to be an age in which wine flowed freely and God provided. She expects Jesus can handle this. Isaiah 25, 6, we already mentioned, but it also occurs in Jeremiah 31, 12, Amos 9, 13, and 14, a bunch of passages in the Old Testament. That's a mark of the Messianic age. So Mary doesn't have a solution herself. She simply trusts her son and tells him, presumes upon him that he'll do something. Doesn't even ask him, just tells him, here's the facts, here's the need, and simply trusts him to do the rest. There's a good point here for us in our own lives. We would do well if we do likewise. How often do we want to tell God what to do? We worry, we fret, and then we want to tell God, this is exactly how you have to handle it. Here's how you must solve this problem for me. Even if it includes a miracle. God, you've got to do this. Our petitions are usually centered on who? Us. Who are they supposed to be centered on? God. Mary doesn't make a request. She simply states the fact. They have no wine. She trusts Jesus will do what's necessary. We need to come to God in the same way and simply present, here's the need. This is it. Matthew 6:32, among many verses, tells us that God knows our needs before we even pray, doesn't he? We have many promises that he will meet our needs, especially if we seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. So here's the need. God, I know you'll take care of it. Our focus is supposed to be first on his kingdom and his righteousness, not on us. Our lives are to be about his glory, not our own. We can trust that all we need to do is go to God and say, here's the problem. Can we trust him to solve the problem? Actually, we can. That's how Mary approaches Jesus. Now, Jesus' response to his mother in verse 4 is a bit hard to understand because the idiom that's used here doesn't translate very well into English. If it was a very wooden translation, it'd be something like this. Jesus says to her, quote, what to me and you, woman, not yet is come the hour of me. Isn't that great English? Yeah, what did you say? Well, first of all, calling his mother woman is not a sign of disrespect. Though it's a distancing of the relationship, it's not disrespect. In fact, Jesus is going to call Mary woman in a few years while he's hanging on the cross and entrusts her care to John. So it's not disrespect. Mary is going to need to recognize that Jesus is not just her son, but more importantly, he is the promised Messiah. She has to trust him. Now, the phrase, what to me and you, is a Hebrew idiom which distances the relationship between the two parties by asking, what is common between these two things? It's not rude, but it is abrupt, with the strength of reproach depending on how you say it, what's the tone used in it. The thrust of Jesus' reply to Mary is that he has entered into the purpose of his mission on earth, and all of his activities are now going to be subject to the fulfillment of that mission. Jesus' statement, his hour was not yet come, points out to this divine schedule that Jesus is on. The blessings of the messianic age are going to come, but that's in the future still. At the same time, Jesus' reply also indicates to Mary, he's going to take care of the problem. Let me give you a very, very, very loose paraphrase of this, maybe to make some sense of it, okay? He tells his mother this, this is my affair, not yours, ma'am. It is not now the messianic age, it will come. That's his answer. She has an expectation, I'll take care of it, but understand the messianic age is not here yet, but I'll take care of the problem. That's his answer to Mary. Now we know that Mary takes this as he is going to solve the problem, and he's taken the responsibility by what she says next. Look at verse 5. His mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Now, Mary, again, she has some authority in this wedding celebration that's going on because she grabs the hired servants and tells them, this is what you must do. Why? It's going to be kind of strange for a waiter to receive orders from a guest. And they're going to need to obey whatever Jesus says, no matter how strange it may seem. Whatever he says, go and do it. Now, these are servants, not slaves. Slaves is doulos, is diakonos. These are people who are hired to serve at this wedding, or guests, or friends of family, somebody, but they're servants. Now, John is probably a first-hand witness because in verses 6 through 8, he states the situation and what occurs in a very matter-of-fact and very detailed manner. Verse 6 says, "Now there were six stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each." Now, these particular water pots were there for the purpose of purification, that is, for washing. The custom of the Jews was to wash their hands before eating, Mark 7:3. And the water was there for that purpose, but it was also there for cleaning up dishes and things like that. So the pots are fairly large, but they're different sizes. The text says they are two or three measures. A measure is 8 to 9 gallons, so each pot is between 17 and 27 gallons. That's a total of 102 to 162 gallons of water. Why? There's a lot of guests present. The water is there for them. Remember, they didn't have running faucets. You brought the water. Now, Jesus gives direction to the servants in verse 7, says to them, "Fill the water pots with water," and they filled them to the brim. So they go off to wherever the nearest fresh water source is, and they proceed to fill the jars, and it says to the very brim, right to the top. Now, that detail eliminates the possibility that something is added into it later on and mixed together, you know, instant wine or something. It eliminates that. It's water right to the top. And they are watching. They would have noticed if something was added. Now you can understand these servants being perplexed. "We've run out of wine. I got the cleaning water pots, and we filled them with water. What's Jesus going to do? Give them water from the cleaning pots? What's this about?" Verse 8, Jesus gives further direction. You have these jars, they're filled to the brim, and he simply says, "Draw out some now and take it to the hand waiter." And they took it to him. Now, they just put the water in it. They know what's in it. He says, "Just draw some out and go take it to the guy who's in charge here," which he does. The result, verse 9. "And when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, 'Every man serves the good wine first, and when men have drunk freely, then that which is poor. You've kept the good wine until now.'" The head waiter, or as the King James says, the ruler of the feast, he's the guy in charge of making sure everything's going properly. He's surprised. "This is good wine." Now, he didn't know where it came from, but again, the servants did know where it came from. They knew they gave him water. He is so impressed by this wine, he's got to go talk to the bridegroom. Now, it doesn't matter when the water turned into wine. People speculate on that. Did all the wine turn into wine? The water turned to wine in the pots, or was it being turned into wine as they were drawing it out? Does it matter? It takes a miracle either way, okay? But this is superb quality. And so the ruler of the feast, this head waiter, he goes to the bridegroom, not a guest at random, is the one who's doing this. This is a guy who is a professional. I don't know if you go in these fancy restaurants, they have these professional wine stewards. They know their wine. I had a class in winemaking in college, how to grow wines and vintage and all that kind of stuff. I haven't a clue about that stuff. There's these guys, they know the backwards and forwards and insides and outs and everything about it. Okay, this is a guy who knows his stuff. He takes it and he goes to the bridegroom and he's got a comment. Why? Because this is really odd. The normal practice, you serve the best wine first when people's taste buds are fresh. They're impressed by what you're giving them. Inferior wine is then served later. Now, that's not a statement that somehow these people were intoxicated. Again, this is a good Jewish wedding. They know the Proverbs. They know the many admonitions about getting drunk. Proverbs 20, verse 1, "Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler. Whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise." Proverbs 23, 21, "For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. This was not about they're drunk and now they can't notice it. It's a simple physical thing that we all have. As you have more and more of something, your taste buds decline in their sensitivity to it. That's why I use the first couple bites are always the best. The more you have of it, it just doesn't make that much of an impression on you. That's why you serve the best wine first. You impress everybody with what good stuff you're serving. Later on, you're not so attentive to that, so you serve the cheaper stuff. You can reduce the cost a little bit. Any of you try and do that in your wedding? You try and keep the cost down? So that's all they're doing. They're keeping the cost down. So in a sense, it's a compliment of what he's doing, but in a sense also kind of a bit of rebuke. Why do you save the good stuff for last? Now, before I go into verse 11, the significance of what Jesus did here, I need to comment a moment about the idea that's being advocated by some that this is not wine. This is non-intoxicating, just grape juice, you know, like Welch's or something. Yes, there is a very legitimate concern about drunkenness. I agree with that. There is a very great concern that people abuse alcohol, abuse wine. But that does not allow us to distort what the scriptures say. The word for wine here is oinos. It's the common Greek word for fermented grape juice, otherwise known as wine. It's the same word as in Ephesians 5:18. Do not be drunk with oinos, wine, but be filled with the Spirit. This is not a. And if you go back historically, there was no means to keep the grapes from fermenting. Not until the 1800s, and Dr. Welch invented this way of pasteurizing grape juice, that he could keep it from fermenting. It would just ferment. It has yeast on it when it's harvested from the field. Even more so, Israel's a warm climate. It ferments very rapidly. In fact, so much so that new wine, which is glukos in Greek, is even intoxicating. In Acts 2:13, it mentions that they thought they might have been drunk on new wine. It was freshly pressed, but already would have alcohol content because it ferments that quickly. The Bible gives a lot of strong warnings about the sin of drunkenness and the dangers of wine, as we've already noted. But the scriptures do not condemn wine as evil, and that's an important distinction. Those who say that Jesus turned the water into non-alcoholic grape juice are either ignorant or they're guilty of twisting the scriptures to fit their own preconceived ideas. That's dangerous. That's a serious sin. Matthew 15:9, 1 Timothy 4:1-5, and a bunch of scriptures give strong warning about that. We do not distort the scriptures to make them say what we'd like them to say. We have to take them for what they say. We have to bend the scriptures. Jesus turned the water into wine. Jesus also drank wine. Matthew 11:34, he was considered, because he was hanging out with them, came eating and drinking, and they said he's a drunkard. He wasn't a drunkard. Never intoxicated, but he drank wine. And he's going to drink it again in his kingdom, according to Matthew 26:29, especially in reference to Isaiah 25:6. He's going to serve it. Aged wine. Fine aged wine. So you cannot use Jesus' use of wine as an excuse for you to abuse wine and get drunk. That's sin, but neither can you twist the scriptures and say that's not what he did. The biblical truth is he made the water into oinos, into wine. Now, what's the significance of this? Well, it's actually multifaceted. The first thing it does is it approves or demonstrates God's approval of marriage and wedding celebrations. And that's nice to know. God approves of them. Second, Jesus' very generous gift of all this abundance of wine to the couple shows his own approval to enjoy the good things of life. Those who think that godliness somehow means an ascetic lifestyle, setting aside anything that you might find pleasure in, have not understood the precious gift of life that God has given us and his desire for us to live it with joy. Now again, we're not to be hedonistic, we're not after the pleasure. But at the same time, we are to be grateful for those things that God lets us enjoy. The difference here is we should be thankful. To who? to God. He's the one who's provided it. Not to be shunning it as, I enjoyed that, I can't have that. No, we can enjoy it and thank God for it, but not pursue it. We are to pursue godliness, we're to pursue God. But those two things are minor points and fail to compare the true significance of what John points out in verse 11. Look at verse 11. This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifest his glory, and his disciples believed in him. It's an attesting miracle that causes disciples to have a greater confidence in him, to trust him, to have faith in him. The glory that he has as the Son of God is strengthened by what he's done. Now, some have tried to lessen the significance of this miracle in various ways, but this is a miracle of the first order. It takes grapes many months to synthesize what's going to become wine, to synthesize the juice. Grapes have the necessary things that God has given it, chlorophyll and other chloroplasts. It takes the sunlight, uses the energy from that, and it synthesizes from water and from air and the nutrients it pulls out of the ground and synthesizes what will become wine, grape juice. Now, this miracle requires something else. Now, if you have all the products together and you're a chemist, you can mix them together and produce something if you have enough time. This plant takes months to do it. Jesus does this instantaneously, but he also does it with things that didn't exist before. Water consists, if you remember a little bit about chemistry, of two elements, hydrogen and oxygen. Wine is 70 to 80% water. But it also contains other things. It contains organic acids. It contains phenolic compounds, nitrogenous compounds, aroma compounds, minerals, and peptic substances. It contains additional elements that were not there. They put in water, hydrogen, oxygen. Jesus instantly turns into wine, which requires the following elements to also be there: carbon, nitrogen, potassium, sodium, iron, sulfur, chlorine, and phosphorus. It also requires that all these elements also be mixed together in exactly the right manner so they produce the compounds that make wine. And all of this is instantaneous. Only God can create the additional elements that did not exist before and make them, and then combine them all together so that it is wine, and not just wine, but superb wine, the best wine. So what does this demonstrate? Jesus is the Son of God because he has the ability to create from nothing. Only God can do that. Jesus told Nathanael a few days earlier that he would see greater things than Jesus' foreknowledge about Nathanael. This is the first of those greater signs. The miracle points to Jesus. And once it does, everything else falls into the background. Who's getting married? Unimportant. Why Mary is there in her exact role in the wedding? Inconsequential. Why was Jesus invited along with disciples, and how many were there? Insignificant. Like a Rembrandt painting, everything else falls in the background as John weaves us together and the focus becomes Jesus, the miracle worker. All attention's on him. He is the Son of God.